irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams and wake up every day and think about what you're going to do that day. Instead of thinking about what you're going to eat, wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you want to call in and talk with me, the number here is 323-203-0815. 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you. Because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, or any kind of problem eating, the real problem is not food. The real problem is what is eating at you. So I want to finish telling you about Arlene and the donuts. I've been reading the article that I wrote for Psyche magazine called How to Stop Emotional Eating. And I've been talking about Arlene, who had a thing... a thing about donuts. And as we worked together, we came to see how Arlene's past had a lot to do with her current donut problem. And you know that I talk a lot about how the past is not in the past. The past is haunting the present. And the whole point of understanding the past is to realize how it's showing up in your present and interfering with your life and affecting your relationship to yourself, to others, and even to food. So if you want to change your relationship to food, you got to understand how the past is affecting the present. And that doesn't mean talking about the past over and over and over again. Does not mean that. That doesn't help anything. It means recognizing that there's something going on today that has its roots in the past. So Arlene, for example, was the oldest of, hold on, I need to just tweak something. Bear with me. Okay. Arlene, for example, was the oldest of 8 children. And her mother expected her to take care of her younger siblings, who were known as the kids, growing up. And she, as a result, Arlene always felt more like a mother's helper than a daughter or a sibling. And her mom also dismissed what she called negative emotions. She told Arlene to quit whining and complaining. She showed a total lack of interest in Arlene's emotional pain. Now, Arlene longed for a loving, warm mommy. A mommy, not a mother, a mommy. But she had to settle for an overwhelmed, unavailable mother. So in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, we look, again, how unresolved dynamics from the past continue to impact our present lives. And that involves looking for symbols. In your current life that provide clues to the past. And that's the source of your difficulty. So when I work with Arlene and when I work with anyone, I look at how the ways in which the unconscious mind makes itself known. Things that are hidden from us that have so much impact on how we think and what we do. So in Arlene's case, remember, if you've been listening, Arlene's problem with donuts began after she gave birth to her first baby. And she thought it was, postpartum or something, like she was depressed and she was eating sugar to pep herself up or whatever. But as we explored it, the birth of her first child triggered a deep hunger to be, hey, Alberto. Hey, Josh. Nice to see you. So when her baby was born, that kind of triggered this wish
to be mothered herself. And so in our sessions, I looked at why she got so fixated on donuts. Like, why donuts? Why not something else? Why not chocolate? Why not, you know, she thought she was eating sugar to pep herself up. Why donuts? It always had to be donuts. So what is distinctive about donuts? Think about it. They have a hole in the center. A donut has a hole in the center. And I really thought it was important to take a look at the symbolic link between this hole in the center of a donut and the emptiness, the symbolic emptiness in Arlene's relationship with her mom. So I suggested that her mind was using donuts to communicate how intensely she felt the absence of mothering in her own life. Now, this symbolic notion of donut holes made a lot of sense to Arlene. And as we processed her unresolved relationship with her mother, she stopped craving donuts. Pretty cool, right? But then she developed what she called a thing for cream-filled donuts. And I also thought that that was significant, and that it was, like things were developing. She was going from, there's a hole, there's something missing in my life, to, I want there to be something there where the hole was. And this is how that actually transpired. One day, she goes to get one of the cream-filled donuts. They're called something. I don't know. Does anyone know what they're called? I guess they're not donuts if they've got a creamy center, but they're like donuts. They got a creamy center. She bites into one of the creamy filled donuts and realized there was no white center. Someone had forgotten to put the cream in the middle. And she got mad. She got really, 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 really mad. She said, "I can't explain why I was so mad." And she was really mad. She's like, "But I needed that cream filling. I needed it." And she, for those of you who are watching me on Instagram, this is what she did. She was like, "I needed it." So she held her hands in front of her chest and cupped them emphatically. "I needed it. I needed it. I needed it." Shaking her hands back and forth. And it was almost like she was cupping her breasts. And I wondered, does that cream filling symbolize mother's milk, something she could actually take in, unlike her mother, who actually was not so available? And this idea also resonated with Arlene. She had progressed from eating donuts with a missing center to craving something sweet, creamy, and filling. And her anger at the missing cream filling represented the unexpressed anger and sadness she felt in childhood, because she was deprived of a warm and soothing mother. And this helped her understand herself better. And you could see, what was the trigger? The trigger was when she became a mother herself. And therefore, she was this, you know, she was a loving mommy to this baby. And it put her in touch with all that she had not gotten from her own mother. And working through the past, working through the deficits in her relationship with her mother, helped Arlene heal. And she stopped using food to express her hunger for the nurturing she had never received. She grieved. This is so important. We have to grieve what we never got. We have to grieve both what happened and what didn't happen. So she had to grieve what she never received from her mother, and she had to learn to mother herself, to nurture herself. And therefore, she could forever free herself from the tyranny of donuts. So to eliminate your own emotional eating, you have to bring these unconscious needs out of the dark and into the light so they could be challenged and worked through. And they can sometimes be difficult to identify on your own. So you might need the help of a therapist, or, write me or call into the show or drop a comment on Instagram and I can help you discover what those hidden ideas are and bring them into the light, which is just another way of saying bringing the unconscious into consciousness. Because when you identify the hidden triggers and you find new ways of responding to yourself, food will stop being your best friend and your worst enemy. And instead, it becomes part of a healthy, balanced life. So that does it for Arlene and the donuts. And if you want to read the whole article, it's on Psyche magazine. And it's called How to Stop Emotional Eating. Now, this brings me to a question I'm getting a lot of people, which is, what is normal eating? Or they'll tell me, oh, I'm trying to eat normally, but I can't. I just can't eat normally. And I'll say, well, what do you think normal eating is? And they'll often say, well, it's, you know, I should wake up and eat like an egg white omelet and with coffee with no creamer. And then for lunch, I should have a salad with, you know, blah, 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 and eat clean. And, it, you know, you get the idea. I hope you know what I mean by blah, blah, blah. Just everything should be just spick and span food with not a gram of a carb or a fat gram or anything like that. That's what they think normal eating is. And of course, you fail miserably when you try to eat normal eating like that, because it's restrictive and it's limited and it's unsustainable. So I want to share with you a definition of normal eating. And this is not my definition. I'm not a dietitian. I deal with the psychology of eating issues, but this is written by a dietitian named Ellen Satter, and the S-A-T-T-E-R. And this is a wonderful definition of normal eating. I think it might surprise you. Here's what she says. She says, normal eating is being able to eat when you're hungry and continue eating until you are satisfied. It's being able to choose foods you like and truly get enough of it, not just stop eating because you think you should. Normal eating is being able to use some moderate constraint in your food selection to get the right food, but not being so restrictive that you miss out of pleasurable foods. Normal eating is giving yourself permission to eat sometimes because you are happy, sad, bored, or just because it tastes good. Normal eating is eating three meals a day most of the time, but it can also be choosing to munch or graze throughout the day. It is leaving some cookies on the plate because you know you can have some tomorrow, or it is eating more now because they taste so wonderful when they are fresh. Normal eating is overeating at times, feeling stuffed and uncomfortable. It is also undereating at times and wishing you had more. Are you surprised so far by this definition? Does this blow your mind? Is this completely not what you thought normal eating was or is? I'm not done. Ellen Satter, dietitian, goes on to say, normal eating is trusting your body to make up for mistakes in eating. And I'm not sure what she means by mistakes in eating, but maybe overdoing it. Normal eating takes up some of your time and attention, but it keeps its place as only one area of your life. Normal eating is flexible. It varies in response to your schedule and your hunger and your proximity to food. So that is a great definition of normal eating. And notice that not anywhere in this definition did she say what you should be eating. Did she say normal eating is eating salads three times a day and eating, you know, egg whites and eating this or that? Eating sushi? No, she doesn't even mention food in here. So normal eating is an attitude. It is not food choices. It is an attitude towards food, which then leads you to food choices. Because if you say, hey, I can't eat pizza, that's bad, and it's bad for me, and it is a bad food, and if I eat it, I will be being bad. And if you eat it, then you feel bad about yourself. And then you might say, well, I've been bad, so I might as well have more pizza. And then since I've had pizza and I've already been bad, I might as well have, you know, ice cream and all the things that are on my cannot eat list. And there you go. Slippery slope. But when you say, do I feel like pizza? Yeah. sounds good. Everyone's eating it. I'm going to have a piece or two. Okay, that was good. Then you don't have this, I ate a bad food, so I feel bad, and now I've blown it. Now I might as well eat the kitchen kind of a thing. So the anticipation of deprivation always leads to binging. And when you don't deprive yourself, you can decide if you want something, and if so, how much. And that is one way to stop binging. Because when you change your attitudes towards food and you don't feel like you are not allowed to eat something, you're not going to give yourself that anticipation of deprivation, then you can eat it and enjoy it and not binge on it. So that is one way in which it's not emotional eating, but it is a way in which our mental construct, our ideas about food, anticipation of deprivation or actual deprivation, can lead to binging. So I just wanted to share that because I have gotten I had something all prepared for you to talk about, and now I can't find it. But I've gotten so many questions about normal eating, so I really wanted to share that. So one of the questions I get a lot about is, what is the unconscious? Dr. Nina, what is the unconscious? And I talk about the unconscious in various ways. One way is I tell people, hey, it's like the invisible army. It's like you can't fight an invisible army. You just get beaten up. But when you make that army visible, you see what you are fighting. Then you can fight. You know what you're fighting. You can fight back and you can win. Another way I talk about it is the weed and the root. When we see a weed, we don't see the root, but we know that the root is there because it is growing the weed. And roots are underground. They're hidden from us. They're in the dark underground. And that is like our unconscious. There are things that we don't know and we don't consciously think, but they are there. And how do we know they're there? Because they grow the weed. And the weed in this case is binge eating, stress eating, eating disorders, dysfunctional relationship to yourself and to food. So one way to think about the unconscious is that, and I also want to differentiate it between the unconscious from the subconscious. Because a lot of people say subconscious, but they really mean unconscious. So subconscious is, for example, let's say you go to the DMV and you have to fill out some paperwork and they say, well, what's your mother's maiden name? You're like, oh, my mother's maiden name. You write it down. It immediately comes to your mind. So in psychoanalytic terms, that's the subconscious. You're not actively always thinking about your mother's maiden name. You're not constantly thinking about it in your conscious mind all the time. It's there, it's in the background. And when you need it, it comes forward and then you talk about it. Or you think about it, you talk about it, you identify it, it's there. The unconscious is there are parts of our mind that are outside our awareness completely. You can't recall them. You can't even know them. They become completely elusive. So the question is, well, if they're not known, how do we know they exist? Since the unconscious is out of awareness but not out of operation, the weeds are there, the behavior is there. There are various ways that we infer the existence of unconscious conflict. So you saw what I talked about with Arlene earlier, right? One of the things that we did was we made her unconscious yearning for maternal love, for getting the love she never got from her mother, that was unconsciously being expressed with donuts, because she couldn't get enough donuts, and she never had really a problem with donuts until after she became a mother herself. So that was one way of us examining, well, what was going on? It was out of her awareness that made itself known in donuts. And by the way, if you would like to join me today, oh my gosh, I always forget the new number here. What is the number? Ronan, what's the number? I know it's 323 when he's writing it. I have it written down somewhere and I don't know what I did with my paper. So if you would like to join me, if you would like to call in and ask me anything having to do with your relationship to food, to yourself, to the world. So remember, eating is a solution. Binge eating, stress eating, it is a solution to the problem. It is not the problem. Let me help you identify the problem, or if you know what the problem is, let me help you resolve it. The number here is 323-203-0815. 323-203-0815. So the idea that parts of our mind are out of awareness can be really disconcerting. One woman said to me, it's like thinking you're in the driver's seat and then discovering you're actually a passenger being chauffeured through life by a mysterious and unknown driver. So psychoanalysis shows us the existence of this secret driver. Is there something within you that is causing the behavior that you don't like? It is not about willpower. It is not about control. It is not about addiction. There is something that is getting expressed, and psychoanalysis shows us the existence of this secret driver, and it allows for the motives and wishes and fears and anxieties to be worked through, and that helps you create a sense of ownership in your own life, and then you can fully step into the driver's seat of your life, which is a good feeling. Another question that I get a lot is, what's with the couch? Why do people in analysis lie on the couch? That's weird. It does seem weird. Well, not everyone in analysis lies on the couch, although that is a very controversial statement and a controversial issue among analysts. But basically, the use of the couch began because Sigmund Freud wanted to avoid having his patients look at him all the time. He said, I felt uncomfortable being stared at 8 hours a day. So he had people lie on the couch, like, hey, pick a load off, lie down. And he did it initially to avoid having people stare at him. And what he didn't realize, and what was a total unexpected bonus, was that it led to things like free association and regression and the development of transference and all of these ways in which we take what is hidden in our minds and bring it into the light. And so let me give you an example. So I had a patient, I'm gonna call her Rose, even though that was not her real name. And she was in her 50s, but she was still traumatized by how her mom used to give her the silent treatment. Like when she was a little kid and her mom was mad at her mom just wouldn't talk to her for what seemed like days to Rose. And so when Rose and I were talking face to face, she had no problem at all. Like she'd ask me something, I might take a moment, think about it, consider it, say something to her, no problem. Then she went on the couch. She began analysis and she went on the couch. And all of a sudden, the smallest silence between us was unbearably long. Like literally 2 seconds would seem like an hour to her. And she would get so anxious and she would have all these thoughts that I was indifferent to her. I was ignoring her. I didn't care about her. I hated her. So what was happening? She began to see me as if she was a little girl, and this is how she experienced her mom, when her mom would give her the silent treatment. And by the way, why did Rose then begin turning to food? Because food represents in our psyche mothering, nurturing, love, comfort. So all the things she wasn't getting when she was getting the silent treatment from her mom, she sort of got symbolically with food. So if you're turning to food, remember, there is always a reason. It may or may not have to do with your relationship with your mother or your father. Although the oldest joke in psychoanalysis is, if it's not one thing, it's your mother. Better said with a Yiddish accent, which I should be able to say because my grandmother did indeed speak Yiddish, but she would be appalled by my terrible rendition of a Yiddish accent, but there you have it. If it's not one thing, it's your mother. You know, sometimes it's your father, sometimes it's your sister, your brother, sometimes it's the teacher that traumatized you in third grade, sometimes it's the stranger that violated you. It could be all different things. But if you are turning to food, it is for a reason, and understanding what that reason is everything. And then finding new ways of responding changes your world. So basically, Rose, when she was on the couch, felt as if she was a little girl and she was with her mom who didn't care about her. And that's how she experienced me. I was ignoring her. I was indifferent. I didn't like her. I hated her. So it was like a little time machine, that couch, and it brought her back to her trauma. And it allowed us to process what had happened to her in the past. It allowed her to process what she felt about that silent treatment so she could tell me what she couldn't tell her mother, which was, hey, I feel like you hate me. Hey, you're ignoring me. This hurts. I'm mad at you. Talk to me. And she was able to heal by re-experiencing what she experienced with her mother earlier in her life. By re-experiencing that, by being on the couch, she could heal the trauma. We could process it. We could work through it. We could talk about it. And by healing her trauma, she could start to be different to herself too. Because what happened when Rose was upset? She gave herself the silent treatment. She basically ignored herself and went to food. So interesting, right? When you look at it like a detective, and that's how I see this work, I am a detective. I am a detective looking for clues. And when I work with someone or when I work in a group, we're detectives, we're co-detectives, and we're looking for clues. And we have to start with an attitude of interest, of curiosity, not criticism. Because a lot of times people will say, oh, I'm so weird. I do this. Or I'm so ashamed of myself. I can't believe I ate the entire bag of chips or every row of that Oreo cookie was gone because I ate the whole thing of whatever the whole thing was. I'm so ashamed of myself. Oh, I feel so terrible. Well, detectives don't do that. They don't say, that's weird. You should be ashamed of yourself. That's a shameful clue. Detectives say, wow, that's really interesting. What does that tell us about you? We're trying to solve the mystery of why you're doing this. Here you're doing this. Let's look for the clues. So when you stay curious and not critical, you are likely to find answers. When you're curious, what was going on with me right before I went to the kitchen? What was going on with me? What was I thinking about? What was I feeling? What's happening in my life? What am I worried about? What did it distract me from? Questions. Those questions lead to answers. So the couch is a time travel machine right into your unconscious mind. And by the way, there are some other ways that we discern the unconscious. One way is what's called Freudian slips. I have been struck by, over the years, how many of my patients say the word hate when they meant to say eight. I remember someone telling me how much she'd eaten during a binge, and she said, oh, I cannot believe how much I hate. She meant to say, I can't believe how much I ate. And that slip of the tongue showed her hatred, her aggression, all these feelings of anger that she disavowed consciously, but that came out. And so even they came out not only in using the word hate instead of ate, they came out in what she was eating, and that she was getting mad at herself. She turned against herself for eating rather than expressing herself. And that is often the case, especially women who are told it's not nice to be angry. Nice girls don't get mad. Don't be mad. Calm down. That I've gotten that my whole life. Calm down. Calm down. Don't get so excited. Don't get so angry. Don't get so fill in the blank. Don't just be calm. Be a nice girl. Nice girls should be calm. Guess what? Nice girls and women don't have to be calm. We get to have feelings and we get to express them as much as we want, because feelings need our attention and we have to express them. And the only way to get rid of feelings is to express them. But when you can't do that, you might express them with food. And many women, not just women, some men, but I find this to be more the case with women, don't allow themselves to express their anger, except they have no problem expressing their anger towards themselves. So they will say, I can't be mad at my husband. He didn't mean to say that to me. Or I can't be mad at my wife. Lots of women have wives these days. I can't be mad at someone else. They can't help it. It's okay. I totally understand why they did that, or it was a mistake, or it was an accident. I have no right to be mad. But you know what I'm mad about? I'm mad about the fact that I ate 3 bagels. That's what I'm mad about. So they don't let themselves be mad at other people, but they sure have no problem stuffing that anger and then getting angry with themselves for eating. Josh is saying, I think there's a hidden female anxiety issue. Well, a hidden female anger issue for sure. Lots of women feel anxiety, but anxiety, you know, anxiety is more along the lines of fear. Anger is a proactive, active, intense emotion that we are programmed from a very young age not to feel. Culturally, there is a prohibition against being strong, speaking your mind. You're bit like a man is strong and a woman is bitchy. Now, I want to give equal opportunity to the guys out there. Again, this does not go to every guy, but I find that men are socialized not to cry. Boys don't cry. Men can't be vulnerable. Don't feel those softer feelings. You're a guy. I've told you before that I was being interviewed on a podcast and talking about the fact that the only way to get rid of feelings was to feel them. And if you don't, you're going to stuff them down or turn to food in some way and express them that way. And the host said, well, I'm a dude. I don't have feelings. Well, yeah, dude, you do. We all do. We're humans. We all have feelings. But men are socialized not to feel sadness and vulnerability and things like that. And so they turn their vulnerability and their sadness into anger. Women convert their anger into sadness. Men convert their sadness into anger. Josh is saying women are supposed to be resigned, and so anxiety issues are hidden underneath. Yes, very interesting. Resignation, give in, don't have a thought, don't have an opinion, go along. Well, then what happens when you don't want to go along? You get mad. No, I don't want to go along. And I hear this from a lot of women. Well, I just want to, I don't want to make waves. I don't want to get anyone mad at me. I don't really care what movie we see. It's fine. Well, you know what? Yeah, you do. You do care. And it's okay to have an opinion. The problem is it's often seen as you're either being selfish or selfless. So it's either I'm selfless, I don't have an opinion, I don't care, I'll do what you want, I don't want to make waves, or oh, I'm going to feel so selfish if I dare speak my opinion. Well, maybe in between is something called self-care. So selfless is I don't matter at all. It's all about you. I don't count. It's all about you. What do you want? Selfless is not healthy. That is not healthy to say, I don't matter. It's all about you. Let me make you happy all the time. Selfish is, I don't care about you. It's all about me. That also is not healthy and it is not good. In between is self-care. Sometimes I'm going to make myself happy and sometimes I'm going to make you happy. Sometimes I'm going to take care of me and sometimes I'm going to take care of you. The problem is if you're so used to giving to other people that anytime you think of yourself, you feel selfish, then you're not going to do it. And sometimes when this is happening, what happens to your wants? What happens to your wishes? What happens to your making a decision for you? Well, that can get acted out with food. You're saying yes to everybody else and no to yourself, but then you say yes to yourself about what you're going to eat. Food for thought. Another way that we discern the unconscious is something called negation. Negation is when a wish is expressed in a negative form or a thought is expressed in a negative form. So it's like the expression of a thought that is simultaneously denied. Let me give you an example. A screenwriter was married to another screenwriter and he found out that his wife had been nominated for an award. And this is what he said about his wife's success. So they're both screenwriters. He's saying, "Oh, I don't compete. We're both in different genres, whatever. It's all good." And then he said, "It's not that I want to compete with her." So, it's not that I want to compete with her. It's not that it's a competition means it's a competition. So, he's saying what it's not. But really, that's what it is. That's what it was. That's what was eating at him, actually. That he didn't want to acknowledge this competition within this competitive streak with his wife. That made him feel guilty. So he said, "It's not that I want to compete." So he consciously denied it, but it came out. It came out in the negation. I remember a patient told me, "It's not that I'm mad at you." I was going on vacation and she found out that I was going on vacation. She said, "Well, it's not that I'm mad at you. You deserve time off. I'm not upset." Total negation. She was very upset that I was leaving on vacation at a time when she was going through a difficult time. But she felt guilty for that thought. So she repressed the thought. She actually repressed any conscious knowledge of her resentment. Consciously, "It's all good. Yeah, go on vacation, Dr. Nina. Have a great time." But she expressed her true thought as a negative. And as we talked about it, eventually she quote unquote admitted. She's like, "Well, I guess I can admit that maybe she was upset," although she did not think it was fair to be upset. And she felt bad for having this resentment towards me for taking a vacation. Like consciously, her conscious mind was, "Hey, you get to take a vacation too. Of course, it's good. You should go. You deserve a vacation." But unconsciously, she did not want me to leave. She wanted me to be there for her at this time. And so she felt too guilty about it. So she repressed the wish, that she repressed the anger, but it came out in negation. "It's not that I'm mad at you." Translation, "I'm mad at you." And of course, this is a person who had trouble expressing wishes for herself or speaking up for herself or doing things for herself. She depleted herself, did everything for everybody else, emptied herself out. And the only thing that went in was food. So symbolically emptying herself out by taking care of everybody constantly. She even had a job where she took care of other people. And the only thing that literally went in, and figuratively, was food. She was so empty that she had to fill up with food. As we began to look at how she felt guilty about having needs of her own or wants of her own, and started speaking up and actually taking care of herself and not just taking care of other people, guess what? She stopped binging. So you see the relationship between, you know, what's eating at you and what you're eating. Okay, another way that we discern the unconscious, this is the coolest way, dreams. Here's an example. Tiffany. Tiffany left home at the age of 17, and she got engaged a few years later. I think she was like 21 years old, and she had no idea how to organize a wedding. And her mother, who lived far away, like they lived across the country, her mother was more interested in finding a husband of her own than in helping Tiffany plan a wedding. And her father had no clue how to help Tiffany plan a wedding. So Tiffany just didn't know what else to do. So she did it herself, and she went to order wedding invitations. She just went to like the local printer and ordered some inexpensive wedding invitations. And the clerk at the printing office was like this older guy who kind of took her order but didn't give her any suggestions. She just told him, okay, this is what I want to say. And he's like, okay, that's it. And the night that she ordered the invitations, she dreamt it was her wedding day and that the only person who showed up was her mother. And her mother said to her, well, nobody else is coming. Of course I'm the only one here. You didn't put the time on the invitation. And Tiffany woke up, freaked out. As soon as the printer was open, she called them and discovered she had absolutely forgotten to put the time on the invitation. So her unconscious mind had registered that and communicated it to her. But she found a way to resolve the problem in the form of her mother's telling her that she had forgotten to put the time on the invitation. So in the dream, she expressed a wish for her mother to help her, even though she disavowed that consciously. I don't need my mother's help. She's selfish. I can't expect anything from her. But in the dream gave expression to, hey, I want my mom's help. In addition to her unconscious mind delivering her to her the news that she had actually messed up the invitation. Dreams are a remarkably helpful window to the unconscious mind. Another cool dream, I had a patient and for a while she would come in and she would say she had these nightmares, and the nightmares were always the same. She would see this number, like a date, a year. Like she'd see like 1927, and it would be small, and it would come at her, and it would become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And she would wake up like a scary number, like coming out of the, like almost like a, like Star Wars, like you know how the in a galaxy long, far, far away, long, long ago, blah, blah, blah. You see the writing. It was like that, only it would come at her. And she would be terrified, and she would wake up terrified, and she'd go to sleep, and there would be another number, you know, 1857. And it would start out small and would just come at her, get bigger and bigger and bigger, and she would wake up terrified. And this would happen over and over every night for like weeks. And she finally told me about these dreams. And at first we're like, well, what is this number? What does this date mean? You know, what does, you know, 1927, any thoughts about that? What are your associations to 1927? Well, I think my grandmother was born in 1927. Like at first we thought about that. And then it hit me. These are years, yes, but they're dates. their dates. And she was just starting to date. And this is her mind's way of talking about telling her how terrified she was to go on a date, any kind of a date. That it was like, you know, it was an idea in her mind, but as it got bigger and bigger and bigger, it threatened to engulf her. It was her way of saying, well, a date, you know, a date is going to lead to scary, awful things. I'm going to be engulfed. I'm going to be overwhelmed. Connection is scary and horrible. So that was pretty cool, right? Dreams are such an interesting way of talking about what you can't know. They help you know what is hidden from you, but they come disguised. She didn't dream of going out with a guy and having it go badly. She dreamt of a date, because dreams are sort of a part of our unconscious is coming up. It wants to be known. And another part of our mind wants to keep it repressed. So the dreams are the result of this kind of two forces, one wanting to become conscious and one wanting to keep it unconscious. So it becomes disguised. And then we have to figure out, well, what's really going on? And by the way, this woman was starting to also eat more because she was so terrified of connection. So she's terrified of dates because she's terrified of dating, and she's terrified of relationships and what that could bring to her. Because in her mind, relationships were scary and they would only lead to bad things. Only bad things. So consciously she wanted to date. Unconsciously, she was terrified even more than she let herself know. But once you make the unconscious conscious, then you can fight it, right? That's what I said. You make the invisible army visible, then you can fight it. Then we could talk about, well, what's scary about dating? What's scary about relationships? What do you think is going to happen if you get involved with someone? And when we could identify and work through the true underlying conflicts and fears and come to terms with it, and have a different relationship to, well, what is dating and what is a relationship, and different expectations, and she could feel more empowered, then she actually could start dating, which she did. And the last I heard from her, she had a little girl. I love it when I get, you know, like updates after patients leave, and I, you know, I open the mail and there's a letter from them, and it's boom, I'm married. I've got a baby. So happy. So gosh, I cannot believe it. That does it for today. Our time together is over for today, but I hope that I gave you some, insight and got you more interested in your own unconscious and what is going on within you. Because remember, when you're curious, not critical, you get to know yourself better. You get to look at what's driving your binge eating or stress eating or emotional eating behavior. And then when you resolve that, all the eating issues resolve. So thank you so much for joining me today on the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific. If you want to listen live at the LA Talk Radio app or here on Instagram, or you can listen later at Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get podcasts. If you like what I have to say and you're interested in learning more, head on over to my website, Dr. Nina Inc., DrNinainc, DrNinainc.com, and get the two free first chapters of my book, The Binge Cure, and let me know what you think. I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.